Harper Audio presents I Am Number 4, The Lost Files, The Legacies, by Pittacus Lore, performed by Devin Sorvery, Jeff Brick, and Kaleo Griffith.
Six's Legacy. Chapter 1. Katarina says there is more than one way to hide. Before we came down here to Mexico, we lived in a suburb of Denver. My name then was Sheila, a name I hate even more than my current name, Kelly. We lived there for 2 years, and I wore barrettes in my hair and pink rubber bracelets on my wrists, like all the other girls at my school. I had sleepovers with some of them, the girls I called my friends. I went to school during the school year, and in the summer I went to a swimmer's camp at the YMCA. I liked my friends and the life we had there okay, but I had already been moved around by my sapon Katarina enough to know that it wasn't going to be permanent. I knew it wasn't my real life. My real life took place in our basement, where Katarina and I did combat training. By day, it was an ordinary suburban rec room, with a big comfy couch and a TV in one corner and a ping-pong table in the other. By night, it was a well-stocked combat training gym, with hanging bags, floor mats, weapons, and even a makeshift pommel horse. In public, Katarina played the part of my mother, claiming that her husband and my father had been killed in a car accident when I was an infant. Our names, our lives, our stories were all fictions, identities for me and Katarina to hide behind. But those identities allowed us to live out in the open, acting normal. Blending in. That was one way of hiding. But we slipped up. To this day, I can remember our conversation as we drove away from Denver, headed to Mexico for no other reason than we'd never been there, both of us trying to figure out how exactly we'd blown our cover. Something I said to my friend Eliza had contradicted something Katarina had said to Eliza's mother. Before Denver, we'd lived in Nova Scotia for a cold, cold winter. But as I remembered it, our story, the lie we'd agreed to tell, was that we'd lived in Boston before Denver. Katarina remembered differently and claimed Tallahassee as our previous home. Then Eliza told her mother, and that's when people started to get suspicious. It was hardly a calamitous exposure. We had no immediate reason to believe our slip would raise the kind of suspicion that would attract the Mogadorians to our location. But our life had gone sour there, and Katarina figured we'd been there long enough as it was. So we moved yet again. The sun is bright and hard in Puerto Blanco, the air impossibly dry. Katarina and I make no attempt to blend in with the other residents, Mexican farmers and their children. Our only regular contact with the locals is our once-a-week trip into town to buy essentials at the small store. We are the only whites for many miles, and though we both speak good Spanish, there's no confusing us for natives of the place. To our neighbors, we are the gringas, strange white recluses. Sometimes you can hide just as effectively by sticking out, Katarina says. She appears to be right. We have been here almost a year, and we haven't been bothered once. We lead a lonely but ordered life in a sprawling, single-level shack tucked between two big patches of farmland. We wake up with the sun, and before eating or showering, Katarina has me run drills in the backyard, running up and down a small hill, doing calisthenics, and practicing Tai Chi. We take advantage of the two relatively cool hours of morning. Morning drills are followed by a light breakfast, then 3 hours of studies, languages, world history, and whatever other subjects Katerina can dig up from the internet. She says her teaching method and subject matter are eclectic. I don't know what that word means, but I'm just grateful for the variety. Katerina is a quiet, thoughtful woman, and though she's the closest thing I have to a mother, she's very different from me. Studies are probably the highlight of her day. I prefer drills. After studies, it's back out into the blazing sun, where the heat makes me dizzy enough that I can almost hallucinate my imagined enemies. I do battle with straw men, shooting them with arrows, stabbing them with knives, or simply pummeling them with my bare fists. But half blind from the sun, I see them as Mogadorians, and I relish the chance to tear them to pieces. Katerina says even though I am only 13 years old, I'm so agile and so strong I could easily take down even a well-trained adult. One of the nice things about living in Puerto Blanco is that I don't have to hide my skills. Back in Denver, whether swimming at the Y or just playing on the street, I always had to hold back to keep myself from revealing the superior speed and strength that Katerina's training regimen has resulted in. We keep to ourselves out here, away from the eyes of others, so I don't have to hide. Today is Sunday, so our afternoon drills are short, only an hour. I am shadowboxing with Katerina in the backyard, and I can feel her eagerness to quit. Her moves are half-hearted, she's squinting against the sun, and she looks tired. I love training and could go all day, but out of deference to her, I suggest we call it a day. "Oh, I suppose we could finish early," she says. I grin privately, allowing her to think I'm the tired one. We go inside, and Katerina pours us two tall glasses of agua fresca, our customary Sunday treat. The fan is blowing full force in our humble shack's living room. Katerina boots up her various computers while I kick off my dirty, sweat-filled fighting boots and collapse to the floor. I stretch my arms to keep them from knotting up, then swing them to the bookshelf in the corner and pull out a tall stack of the board games we keep there. Risk, Stratego, Othello. Katerina has tried to interest me in games like Life and Monopoly, saying it wouldn't hurt to be well-rounded. But those games never held my interest. Katerina got the hint, and now we only play combat and strategy games. Risk is my favorite, and since we finished early today, I think Katerina will agree to playing it even though it's a longer game than the others. Risk? Katerina is at her desk chair, pivoting from one screen to the next. Risk of what? She asks absently. I laugh, then shake the box near her head. She doesn't look up from the screens, but the sound of all those pieces rattling around inside the box is enough for her to get it. Oh, she says. Sure. I set up the board. Without asking, I divvy up the armies into hers and mine, and begin placing them all across the game's map. We've played this game so much, I don't need to ask her which countries she'd like to claim, or which territories she'd like to fortify. She always chooses the U.S. and Asia. I happily place her pieces on those territories, knowing that from my more easily defended territories, I will quickly grow armies strong enough to crush hers. I'm so absorbed in setting up the game, I don't even notice Katerina's silence. Her absorption. It is only when I crack my neck loudly and she neglects to scold me for it. Please don't, she usually says, squeamish about the sound it makes, that I look up and see her, staring open-mouthed at one of her monitors. Cat? I ask. She's silent. I get up from the floor, stepping across the game board to join her at her desk. It is only then that I see what has so completely captured her attention. A breaking news item about some kind of explosion on a bus in England. I groan. Katerina is always checking the internet and the news for mysterious deaths. Deaths that could be the work of the Mogadorians. Deaths that could mean the second member of the Guard has been defeated. She's been doing it since we came to Earth, and I've grown frustrated with the doom and gloom of it. Besides, it's not like it did us any good the first time. I was 9 years old, living in Nova Scotia with Katerina. Our training room there was in the attic. Katerina had retired from training for the day, but I still had energy to burn and was doing moors and spindles on the pommel horse alone when I suddenly felt a blast of scorching pain on my ankle. I lost my balance and came crashing down to the mat, clutching my ankle and screaming in pain. My first scar. It meant that the Mogadorians had killed Number One, the first of the Guard. And for all of Katerina's web scouring, it had caught us both completely unaware. We waited on pins and needles for weeks after, expecting a second death and a second scar to follow in short order. But it didn't come. I think Katerina is still coiled, anxious, ready to spring. But 3 years have passed, almost a quarter of my whole life, and it's just not something I think about much. I step between her and the monitor. It's Sunday. Game time. Please, Kelly. She says my most recent alias with a certain stiffness. I know I will always be Six to her. In my heart, too. These aliases I use are just shells. They're not who I really am. I'm sure back on Lorien I had a name, a real name, not just a number. But that's so far back, and I've had so many names since then, that I can't remember what it was. Six is my true name. Six is who I am. Katerina bats me aside, eager to read more details. We've lost so many game days to news alerts like this, and they never turn out to be anything. They're just ordinary tragedies. Earth, I've come to discover, has no shortage of tragedies. Nope, it's just a bus crash. We're playing a game. I pull at her arms, eager for her to relax. She looks so tired and worried. I know she could use the break. She holds firm. It's a bus explosion. And apparently, she says, pulling away to read from the screen, the conflict is ongoing. The conflict always is, I say, rolling my eyes. Come on. She shakes her head, giving one of her frazzled laughs. Okay, she says. Fine. Katerina pulls herself away from the monitors, sitting on the floor by the game. It takes all my strength not to lick my chops at her upcoming defeat. I always win at risk. I get down beside her, on my knees. You're right, Kelly, she says, allowing herself to grin. I needn't panic over every little thing. One of the monitors on Katerina's desk lets out a sudden ding, one of her alerts. Her computers are programmed to scan for unusual news reports, blog posts, even notable shifts in global weather, all sifting for possible news of the Guard. Oh, come on, I say. But Katerina is already off the floor and back at the desk, scrolling and clicking from link to link once again. Fine, I say, annoyed. But I'm showing no mercy when the game begins. Suddenly, Katerina is silent, stopped cold by something she's found. I get up off the floor and step over the board, making my way to the monitor. I look at the screen. It is not, as I'd imagined, a news report from England. It is a simple, anonymous blog post. Just a few haunting, tantalizing words. 9. Now 8. Are the rest of you out there? Chapter 2. There is a cry in the wilderness from a member of the guard. Some girl or boy, the same age as me, looking for us. In an instant, I've seized the keyboard from Katerina, and I hammer out a response in the comments section. We are here. Katerina bats my hand away before I can hit enter. 6! I pull back, ashamed of my imprudence, my haste. We have to be careful. The Mogadorians are on the hunt. They've killed one. For all we know, they have a path to 2. To 3. But they're alone, I say. The words come out before I have a chance to think what I'm saying. I don't know how I know this. It's just a hunch I have. If this member of the guard has been desperate enough to reach out on the internet looking for others, his or her sepan must have been killed. I imagine my fellow guard's panic, her fear. I can't imagine what it would be like to lose my Katerina, to be alone, to consider all I deal with without Katerina. It's unimaginable. What if it's 2? What if she's in England and the Moogs are after her and she's reaching out for help? A second ago, I was scoffing at Katerina's absorption in the news. But this is different. This is a link to someone like me. Now I am desperate to help them, to answer their call. Maybe it's time, I say, bawling my fist. Time? Katerina is scared, wearing a baffled expression. Time to fight! Katerina's head falls into her hands, and she laughs into her palms. In moments of high stress, Katerina sometimes reacts this way. She laughs when she should be stern, gets serious when she should laugh. Katerina looks up and I realize she is not laughing at me. She is just nervous and confused. Your legacies haven't even developed, she cries. How could we possibly start the war now? She gets up from the desk, shaking her head. No, we are not ready to fight. Until your powers are manifest, we will not start this battle. Until the guard is ready, we must hide.
Then we have to send her a message.
Her? You don't know it's a she? For all we know, it's no one. Just some random person using language that accidentally tripped my alert.
I know it's one of us, I say, fixing Katerina with my eyes. And you do too.
Katerina nods, admitting defeat.
Just one message, to let them know they're not alone, to give her hope.
Her, again, laughs Katerina, almost sadly. I think it's a girl, because I imagine whoever wrote the message to be like me, a more scared and more alone version of me. One who's been deprived of her sepan. Okay, she says. I step between her and the monitor, my fingers hovering over the keys. I decide the message I've already typed, "We are here," will suffice. I hit enter. Katerina shakes her head, ashamed to have indulged me so recklessly. Within moments, she is at the computer, scrubbing any trace of our location from the transmission. Feel better? She asks, turning off the monitor. I do, a little. To think I've given a bit of solace and comfort to one of the guard makes me feel good, connected to the larger struggle. Before I can respond, I'm electrified by a pain, the likes of which I've only known once before. A lava-hot lancet digging through the flesh of my right ankle. My leg shoots out from beneath me, and I scream, attempting to distance myself from the pain by holding my ankle as far from the rest of me as I can. Then I see it.
the flesh on my ankle sizzling, popping with smoke. A new scar, my second, snakes its way across my skin.
Katerina!
I scream, punching the floor with my fists, desperate with pain. Katerina is frozen in horror, unable to help. The second, she says. Number two is dead. Chapter 3. Katerina rushes to the tap, fills a pitcher, and dumps it across my leg. I am nearly catatonic from the pain, biting my lip so hard it bleeds. I watch the water sizzle as it hits my burned flesh. Then it floods the game board, washing the army pieces off onto the floor. "You win," I say, making a feeble joke. Katerina doesn't acknowledge my attempt at wit. My protector, she has gone into full-on Saipan mode, pulling first aid supplies out from every corner of our shack. Before I know it, she's applied a cooling salve to my scar and wrapped and taped it with gauze. "Six," she says, her eyes moist with fear and pity. I'm taken aback. She only uses my real name in moments of extreme crisis. But then I realize that's what this is. Years had passed since one's death, without incident. It had gotten easy to imagine it was a fluke. If we were feeling really hopeful, we could imagine one had died in an accident, that the Mogadorians hadn't caught our scent. That time is over. We know for sure now. The Mogadorians have found the second member of the guard and killed him or her. Two's message to us, to the world, was the last thing he or she would ever do. Their violent death was now written across my skin. We know two deaths is no fluke. The countdown has truly begun. I almost faint, but pull myself to consciousness by biting my lip even harder. "Six," Katerina says, wiping the blood from my mouth with a cloth. "Relax." I shake my head. No. I can never relax. Not ever. Katerina is straining to keep her composure. She doesn't want to frighten me. But she also wants to do the right thing. To honor her responsibilities as a Saipan. I can tell she's torn between every possible reaction, from outright panic to philosophical cool. Whatever is the best for me and for the fate of the guard. She cradles my head, wipes the sweat from my brow. The water and the salve have taken the sharpest edge off the pain, but it still hurts as bad as the first time, maybe worse. But I won't comment on it. I can see that my pain, and this evidence of Two's passing, is tormenting Katerina enough. "We'll be okay," says Katerina. "There are still many others." I know she is speaking carelessly. She doesn't mean to put the lives of the guard before me. 3, 4, and 5. Ahead of my own. She is just grasping for consolation. But I won't let it pass. "Yeah, it's so great others have to die before me." "That's not what I meant." I can see my words have upset her. I sigh, putting my head against her shoulder. Sometimes, in my heart of hearts, I use a different name for Katerina. Sometimes, to me, she's not Katerina, or Vicky, or Celeste, or any of her other aliases. Sometimes, in my mind, I call her Mom. Chapter 4. We're on the road an hour later. Katerina white-knuckles the steering wheel of our truck through country roads, cursing her choice of hideaway. These roads are too rough and dusty to go faster than 40 miles per hour, and what we both want is the speed of a highway, anything to put as much distance as possible between us and our now abandoned shack. Katerina did what she could to scrub our tracks. But if what we imagine is true, the Mogadorians killing 2 seconds after we saw her fatal blog post, then they moved fast, and they could be racing towards our abandoned home right now. As I watched the fields and the hills pass through the passenger window, I realized that they could already be at the shack. In fact, they could already be following us on the road. Feeling like a coward as I do it, I crane my neck and look through the rear window, through the dust trail our truck kicks up in our wake. No cars trail us. Not yet, at least. We packed light. The truck was already loaded with a first aid kit, a lightweight camping set, bottled water, flashlights, and blankets. Once I was ready to walk again, all I had to do was pick out a few items of clothing for the road and retrieve my chest from the lockbox under the shack. The panic of flight gave me little time to feel the searing pain of my second scar, but it returns to me now, lacerating and insistent. "We shouldn't have responded," says Katerina. "I don't know what we were thinking." I look at Katerina for signs of judgment on her face. After all, I'm the one who insisted we write back, and I'm relieved to find none. All I see is her fear and her determination to get us as far away as possible. I realize that in the confusion and haste to flee, I forgot to notice if we turned north or south at the crossing at the edge of Puerto Blanco. "U.S.?" I ask. Katerina nods, pulling our most recent passports from the inside pocket of her army jacket, tossing mine into my lap. I flip it open and peer at my new name. "Marin Elizabeth," I say aloud. Katerina puts a lot of time into her forgeries, though I usually complain about the names she chooses for me. When I was 8 and we were moving to Nova Scotia, I begged and begged to be named Starla. Katerina vetoed the suggestion. She thought it was too attention-getting, too exotic. I almost laugh to think about it now. A Katerina in Mexico is about as exotic as you can get. And, of course, she's keeping it. Katerina has grown attached to her own name. Sometimes I suspect that Sapons aren't so different from parents, after all. Marin Elizabeth. It's no Starla, but I like how it sounds. I reach down and cradle my calf, just above the throbbing scars on my ankle. By squeezing my calf, I can muffle the pain of my sizzled flesh. But as the pain fades, the fear returns. The fear of our present situation. The horror of 2's death. I decide to let go of my calf, and I let my leg burn. Katerina refuses to stop the car for anything but gas and pee breaks. It's a long trip, but we have ways to pass the time. Mostly we play Shadow, a game that Katerina made up during our previous travels, out of our desire to keep training even when we couldn't do physical drills. A Mogadorian scout races at you from 2 o'clock, wielding a 20-inch blade in his left arm. He swings. "I crouch," I say. "Dodge left." He swings around, the blade above your head. From the ground, a kick to the groin, a leg sweep from his right side to his left. On his back, but he grabs your arm. I let him. I use the force of his grip to swing my legs free, up, and then down to his face. Step on his face, pull my hand free. It's a strange game. It forces me to separate the physical from reality, to fight with my brain and not my body. I used to complain about games of Shadow, saying it was all made up, that it wasn't real. Fighting was fists and feet and heads. It wasn't brains. It wasn't words. But the more Shadow we played, the better I got at drills, especially hand-to-hand drills with Katerina. I couldn't deny that the game made good practice. It made me a better fighter. I have come to love it. I run, I say. Too late, she says. I almost complain, knowing what's coming. You forgot about the sword, she says. He's already swung it up and nicked your flank. No, he didn't, I say. I froze his sword and shattered it like glass. Oh, did you now? Katerina is tired, eyes bloodshot from 10 straight hours of driving, but I can see I'm amusing her. I must have missed that part. Yeah, I say, starting to grin myself. And how'd you pull off that feat? My legacy. It just kicked in. Turns out I can freeze stuff. This is make-believe. I have yet to develop my legacies, and I have no idea what they'll be when they arrive. That's a good one, says Katerina. Chapter 5. We crossed the U.S. border hours back, without a hitch. I have never understood how Katerina manages to make such incredible forgeries. Katerina is pulling us into a dusty pit stop off the highway. There's a tiny single-story motel, an old-fashioned and decrepit diner, and a gas station, newer and brighter than the other two buildings. It is barely dusk when we step out of the truck. The faintest pink of sunrise creeps over the horizon, just enough to add a strange hue to our flesh as we stumble out onto the gravel. Katerina curses, getting back into the car. Forgot to get gas, she says. Wait here. I do as I'm told, watching her pull the truck from the motel parking lot towards one of the pumps. We have agreed to rest up at the motel for a day or two, to recover from our grueling 15-hour drive and the shock of recent events. But even though we'll be here for some time, the tank must be filled. That's Katerina's policy. Never leave an empty tank, she says. I think she says it as much to remind herself as to educate me. It's a good policy. You never know when you'll have to leave in a hurry. I watch Katerina pull up to the pump and start filling the car. I examine my surroundings. Through the front window of the diner across the lot, I can see a few grizzled-looking truckers eating. Through the scent of exhaust and the faint odor of gas fumes from the pumps, I can smell breakfast food in the air. Or maybe I'm just imagining it. I am incredibly hungry. My mouth waters at the thought of breakfast. I turn my back on the diner, trying not to think about food, and look at the town on the other side of the fence from the pit stop. Houses only a step up from clapboard shacks. A ragged, desolate place. Hello, miss. Startled, I whiz around to see a tall, gray-haired cowboy strutting past. It takes me a second to realize that he's not starting a conversation, merely being polite as he passes. He gives a little nod of his 10-gallon hat and proceeds past me into the diner. My heart rate is up. I had forgotten this aspect of the road. When we're settled in a place, even a remote one like Puerto Blanco, we get to know the local faces. We know, more or less, who to trust. I've never seen a Mogadorian in my life, but Katerina says that most of the Mogadorians look like anyone else. After what happened to 1 and 2, I feel a deep unease all around me, a new alertness. A roadside rest stop is especially troublesome in that everyone is a stranger to everyone, so no one raises any eyebrows. Not really. For us, that means anyone could be a threat. Katerina has parked the car and approaches me with a weary grin. Eat or sleep? She asks. Before I can answer, she's raised her hand hopefully.
My vote for sleep.
My vote is to eat. Katerina deflates at this. You know, eat beats sleep, I say. Always does.
It is one of our rules of the road, and Katerina quickly accepts the verdict.
Okay, Marin Elizabeth, she says. Lead the way.
Chapter 6. The diner is humid with grease. It is barely 6 a.m., but almost all of the booths are full, mostly with truckers. While I wait for our food, I watch these men shovel hearty, well-syrupped forkfuls of breakfast meat, sausage, bacon, scrapple, into their mouths. When my food finally comes, I find myself more than holding my own. 3 pancakes, 4 strips of bacon, a side of hash, 1 tall OJ. I finish with a rude belch that Katerina is too tired to chastise me for.
Do you think? I ask.
Katerina laughs, anticipating my question.
How is that possible?
I shrug. She nods and calls the waitress over. With a guilty grin, I order another stack of pancakes.
Well, says the waitress with a dry smoker's cackle, your little girl sure can put it down.
The waitress is an older woman, with a face so lined and haggard you could mistake it for a man's.
Yes, ma'am, I say.
The waitress leaves.
Your appetite will never cease to amaze me, Katerina says, but she knows the reason for it.
I train constantly, and though I'm only 13 years old, I already have the tightly muscled body of a gymnast. I need a lot of fuel, and am not ashamed of my appetite. Another customer enters the crowded diner. I notice the other men give him a suspicious glance as he makes his way to a booth in the rear. They looked at me and Katerina with similar suspicion when we first entered. I took this place for a way station, filled with strangers. But apparently some strangers are worthy of suspicion, and others aren't. Katerina and I are doing our best, dressed in generic American mall clothes, t-shirts and khaki shorts. I can see why we stand out. Apparently they have a different definition of generic here in the far reaches of West Texas. This other stranger is harder to figure, though. He's dressed the part, more or less, wearing one of those Texas ties with the dangly strands of black leather, and like the rest of the men here, he's wearing boots. But his clothes seem somehow out of date, and there's something creepy about his thin black mustache. It looks straight at first glance, but the more I consider it, something about it just seems crooked. It's impolite to stare. Katerina, chiding me again.
I wasn't staring, I lie. I was looking. With interest.
Katerina laughs. She's laughed more in the past 24 hours than she has in months. This new Katerina is going to take some getting used to. Not that I mind. I stretch out luxuriantly on the hotel bed while Katerina showers in the bathroom. The sheets are cheap, polyester or rayon, but I'm so tired from the road they may as well be silk. When Katerina first pulled the sheets down, we found a live earwig under the pillow, which grossed her out, but didn't bother me.
Kill it, she begged, covering her eyes.
I refused. It's just an insect.
Kill it, she begged.
Instead, I swept it off the bed and hopped into the cool sheets.
Nope,
I said stubbornly.
Fine,
she said, and went to shower. She turned the faucets on, but stepped out of the bathroom again a moment later.
I worry,
she started. About what? I asked.
I worry that I haven't trained you well.
I rolled my eyes.
'Cause I won't kill a bug?
Yes.
No, I mean, it's what got me thinking.
You need to learn to kill without hesitation. I haven't even taught you to hunt rodents, let alone Mogadorians. You've never killed anything.
Katerina paused, the water still running behind her, thinking. I could tell she was tired, lost in a thought.
She gets like that sometimes, if we've been training too gruelingly.
Cat, I said, go shower. She looked up, her reverie broken. She chuckled and closed the door behind her. Waiting for her to finish, I turned on the TV from the bed. The previous tenant had left it on CNN, and I'm greeted with the sight of helicopter footage of the event in England. I watch only long enough to learn that both the press and English authorities are confused as to what exactly happened yesterday. I'm too tired to think about this. I'll get the details later. I shut off the TV and lay back on the bed, eager for sleep to take me. Katerina steps out of the bathroom moments later, wearing a robe and brushing out her hair. I watch her through half-closed eyes. There is a knock on the door. Katerina drops her brush on the bureau.
Who is it?
She asks.
Manager, miss. I brought you some fresh towels.
I'm so annoyed by the interruption. I want to sleep, and it's pretty obvious we don't need fresh towels since we only just got to the room, that I propel myself right off the bed, barely thinking. We don't need any, I say, already swinging the door open. I just have time to hear Katerina say,
Don't!
Before I see him, standing before me, the crooked mustache man. The scream catches in my throat as he enters the room and shuts the door behind him. Chapter 7. I react without thinking, pushing him towards the door, but he flings me back easily against the bed. I clutch my chest and realize with horror that my pendant is out from under my shirt, in plain view.
Pretty necklace, he growls. His eyes flashing with recognition. If he had any doubt about who I am, it is long gone.
Katerina charges forward, but he strikes her hard. She crashes against the TV set, smashing the screen with a bare elbow, and falls to the ground. He pulls something from his waist, a long, thin blade, and raises it so quickly I don't even have time to stand. I see only the flash of his blade as he swings it down, straight down, like a railroad spike, into my brain. My head floods instantly with warmth and light. This is what death feels like, I think. But no, the pain doesn't come. I look up. How can I see? I think, I'm dead. But I do see, and realize that I'm covered, from head to toe, in hot red blood. The crooked mustache man still has his arm outstretched, his mouth is still frozen in victory, but his skull has been split open as if by a knife, and his blood is spilling out across my knees. I hear Katerina wail. It's such a primal noise that I can't tell if it's a cry of grief or a scream of relief, as the man, emptied of blood, turns quickly to dust, collapsing in on himself as an ashy heap. Before I can take a breath, Katerina is up, shedding her robe and throwing on clothes, grabbing our bags.
He died, I say. I didn't.
Yes, Katerina replies.
She puts on a white blouse, which she instantly ruins with the blood from her elbow, shredded from the TV screen. She throws it out, blots the blood from her elbow with a towel, and puts on another shirt. I feel like a child, speechless, immobile, covered in blood on the floor. That was it. The moment I've been training for my whole life, and all I managed was a feeble, easily deflected shove before getting tossed aside and stabbed. He didn't know, I say. He didn't know, she says. What he didn't know is that any harm inflicted on me out of order would instead be inflicted upon my attacker. I was safe from direct attack. I knew it, but I also didn't really know it. When he stabbed me in the head, I thought I was dead. It took seeing it to believe it. I reach up and touch my scalp. The flesh there is unbroken. It's not even damp. There's the proof. We are protected by the charm. As long as we stay apart from each other, we can only be killed in the order of our number. I realize his blood has now turned to dust along with his flesh. I am no longer drenched in it. We have to go! Katerina has shoved my chest into my arms, her face pressed right up to mine. I realize I've spaced out, gone to a place inside my own head, reeling from the shock of what just happened. I can tell from the way she says it that this is the third or fourth time she's repeated it, though I am only just hearing her. Now, she says. Katerina drags me by the wrist, her bag slung over her shoulder. The hot asphalt of the parking lot burns the soles of my shoeless feet as we rush outside towards the truck. I carry my chest, which feels heavy in my arms. I have been preparing for battle my whole life, and now that it's come, all I want is to sleep. My heels drag. My arms are heavy. Faster, says Katerina, pulling me along. The truck's unlocked. I get into the passenger seat as Katerina tosses our stuff in the bed of the truck and hops into the driver's seat. No sooner has she closed her door than I see a man racing towards us. For a moment, I think it's the hotel manager, chasing us for fleeing our bill. But then I recognize him as the cowboy from before, the one who gave me the polite nod of his cowboy hat. There's nothing polite about the way he's racing towards us now, his fist upraised. His hand smashes through the glass of the passenger door, and I'm sprayed with glass. His fist closes around the fabric of my shirt, and I feel myself lifted out of my seat. Katerina screams. Hey! A voice from outside. My hand scrambles, looking for something, anything, to keep me in my seat. It finds only my unbuckled seatbelt, which gives easily as the Moog starts pulling me through the window. I feel Katerina's hand clutching the back of my shirt.
I'd think twice about that,
I hear a man's voice shout, and soon I am released, falling back into the seat. I am breathless, my head spinning. Outside the truck, a crowd has formed. Truckers and cowboys, ordinary American men. They've encircled the Moog. One of them has a shotgun raised, pointed right at him. With a wry, bitter smile, the Moog lifts his arms in surrender.
The keys?
Katerina is panicking, near tears. I left them in the room. I don't think. I just move. I don't know how long the Moog will be contained by the protective mob, our saviors, but I don't care. I race back to the room, swipe the keys off the night table, and head back out into the heat of the parking lot. The Moog is kneeling on the ground now, surrounded by angry men.
We called the cops, miss,
says one of them. I nod, my eyes teary. I'm too keyed up even to say thanks. It's strange and wonderful to consider that none of these men know us, but they came to our aid. Yet frightening that they don't understand this Moog's true power. That if he hadn't been instructed to keep a low profile, he'd have torn the skin clean off each of their bodies by now. I get in the car and hand Katerina the keys. Moments later, we pull out of the lot. I turn back for one last glance and lock eyes with the Moog. His eyes brim with reptilian hate. He winks as we pull away. Chapter 8. Katerina was wrong. I have killed before. Years ago, in Nova Scotia. It was early winter, and Katerina had released me from our studies to go play in our snowy backyard. I took to the yard like a demon, running circles in the snow in my baggy clothes, leaping into snowbanks and aiming snowballs at the sun. I hated my cumbersome jacket and waterproof pants, so once I was sure Katerina had turned from the window, I shed them, stripping down to my jeans and t-shirt. It was below freezing outside, but I've always been tough about the cold. I continued to play and race when Clifford, the neighbor's Saint Bernard, came bounding over to play with me. He was a huge dog, and I was small then, even for my age. So I climbed on top of him, clutching the warm fur of his flank. "Giddy up!" I squealed, and he took off. I rode him like a pony, running laps around the yard. Katerina had recently told me more about my history and about my future. I wasn't old enough to fully understand, but I knew it meant I was a warrior. This sat well with me, because I had always felt like a hero, a champion. I took this ride with Clifford as another practice run. I imagined chasing faceless enemies around the snow, hunting them down and taking them out. Clifford had just run me to the edge of the woods when he stopped and growled. I looked up and saw a pale brown winter rabbit darting between the trees. Seconds later, I was on my back, tossed off by Clifford. I picked myself up and dashed after Clifford into the woods. My imaginary chase had become a very real one, as Clifford ran after the darting rabbit, and I followed him. I was delirious, breathless, happy. Or I was, until the chase ended. Clifford caught the rabbit in his jaws and reversed course back to his owner's yard. I was equally dismayed by the end of the pursuit and by the likely end of the rabbit's life. And I now stalked after Clifford, attempting to command the rabbit's release. "Bad dog," I said. "Very bad dog." He was too content with his achievement to pay me any mind. Back in his yard, he happily nuzzled and nipped the damp fur of the rabbit. It took shoving him forcibly from the rabbit's body for him to give it up, and even then he snapped at me. I hissed at Clifford, and he grumpily padded off in the snow. I looked down at the rabbit, matted and bloody. But it wasn't dead. All of my hardness gave way as I lifted the light, furry beast to my chest. I felt its tiny heart beating furiously at the brink of death. Its eyes were glassy, uncomprehending. I knew what would happen to it. Its wounds were not deep, but it would die of shock. It wasn't dead now, but it was past life. The only thing this creature had to look forward to was the paralysis of its own fear and a slow, cold death. I looked to the window. Katerina was out of sight. I turned back to the rabbit, knowing in an instant what the kindest thing to do was.
You are a warrior, Katerina had said.
I am a warrior.
My words turned to frost in the air before my face. I grabbed the gentle creature's neck with both hands and gave it a good hard twist.
I buried the rabbit's corpse deep beneath the snow, where even Clifford couldn't find it.
Katerina was wrong. I have killed before.
Out of mercy.
But not yet out of vengeance.
Chapter 9. Katerina pulls the truck off the dirt road and we get out. It's been a day of straight driving, and it's now 3 in the morning. We're in Arkansas, in the Lake Washita State Park. The park entrance was closed, so Katerina broke through a chain barrier and snuck the truck in, off-roading in the dark of the woods until we came to the main camp road. We've been here before, though I don't remember it. Katerina says we camped here when I was much younger, and that she had thought it would make a good burial site for my chest, if it ever came to that. It has, apparently, come to that. Outside the truck, I can hear the lake lapping weakly at the shore. Katerina and I walk through the trees, following its sound. I carry the chest in my arms. We've decided it's too cumbersome and too dangerous to hold on to. Katerina says it must not fall into Mogadorian hands. I don't press her on this point, though there is a dark implication to this task that haunts me. If Katerina thinks it's come to the point of burying the chest to keep it safe, then she must think our capture has become likely, perhaps inevitable. I shiver in the cool of the night while swatting mosquitoes away. There are more of them the closer we get to the water's edge. We finally come to the shore. In the middle of the lake, I see a small green island, and I know Katerina well enough to know what she's thinking.
I'll do it, she says.
But she only barely gets the words out. She is exhausted, on the brink of collapse. She hasn't slept in days. I've barely slept either, only a few quick minutes here and there in the car. But that's more than Katerina's had, and I know she needs rest.
Lie down, I say. I'll do it.
Katerina makes a few weak protests, but before long she's lying on the ground by the shore.
Rest, I say.
I take the blanket she brought out to use as a towel, and instead use it to drape her, to hide her from the mosquitoes. I strip off my clothes, then grab the chest tight and step into the water. It's bracing at first, but once I'm submerged, it's actually fairly warm. I begin an awkward doggy paddle, using one arm to stroke through the water and the other to clutch the chest. I've never swum at night before, and it takes all of my will not to imagine hands reaching up from the murky depths to grab at my legs and pull me under. I stay focused on my goal. I arrive at the island after what feels like an hour, but is more likely 10 minutes. I step out of the water, trembling as the air hits my bare skin, and walk awkwardly over the stones littering the shore. I walk to the center of the small island. It is nearly round and probably less than an acre, so it doesn't take long to reach. I dig a hole 3 feet deep, which takes considerably longer than the swim out. By the end, my hands are bleeding from clawing through the rough dirt, stinging more and more with each bare-handed shovel through the soil. I place the chest in the hole. I am reluctant to let it go, though I have never seen its contents, never even opened it. I consider saying a prayer over it, the source of so much potential and promise.
I decide against praying. Instead, I just kick dirt into the hole until it's covered and smooth over the mound. I know I may never see my chest again. I return to the water and swim back to Katerina. Chapter 10. It's been a week since we arrived in upstate New York. We're at a small motel adjacent to an apple orchard and a neighborhood soccer field. Katerina has been plotting our next move. There have been no suspicious announcements on the news or on the internet. This gives us some measure of hope for the future of Lorien, and also that the Mogadorian's trail on us has gone cold. It's silly, but I feel ready to fight. I may not have been back at the motel, but I am now. I don't care if I don't have my legacies. It is better to fight than to run. "You don't mean that," she says. "We must be prudent." So we wait. Katerina's heart has gone out of training, but we still do as best we can. Push-ups and shadow boxing in our room during the day, more elaborate drills out in the unlit corners of the soccer field at night. During the day, I'm allowed to wander through the orchards, smelling the sweet rot of fallen apples. Katerina has told me not to play on the soccer field during the day, or talk to the children who practice on it. She wants to continue to keep a low profile. But I can watch the field from behind a tree at the edge of the orchard. It's a girls' team playing today. The girls are all in purple jerseys and bright white shorts. They're about my age. From beneath the shade of the apple tree, I wonder what it would be like to give myself to something as light and inconsequential as a game of soccer. I imagine I'd be good at it. I love being physical. I'm strong and quick. No, I'd be great at it. But it's not for me to play games of no value. I feel envy creep up my throat like bile. It's a new sensation for me. I am usually resigned to my fate, but something about this time on the road, about the near miss with the Mogadorians, has opened me to hating these girls with their easy lives. But I choke it down. I need to save my spite for the Mogs. That night, we allow ourselves to watch a little TV before bed. It is a luxury Katerina usually denies me, as she thinks it rots my brain and dulls my senses. But even Katerina softens sometimes. I curl up next to Katerina on the queen bed. She's turned the TV to a movie about a woman who lives in New York City and complains about how hard it is to find a good man. My attention wanders quickly away from the screen to Katerina's face, which has gone soft with attention to the film's plot. She has succumbed to it. She catches me looking at her and turns red in an instant. "I'm allowed to be sappy sometimes," she turns back to the screen. "I can't help it. He's handsome." I look back at the TV. The woman is now yelling at the handsome man about how he's a sexist pig. I've seen very few movies in my life, but I can already guess how this one ends. The man is handsome, I suppose, though I'm not as transfixed by him as Katerina is. "Have you ever had a boyfriend?" I ask her. She laughs. "Back on Lorien? Yes, I was married." My heart seizes, and I blush at my own self-absorption. How could I have never asked her this before? How could I not have known that she had a husband? A family? I hesitate before asking another question, because I can only assume her husband died in the Mogadorian invasion. My heart breaks for my Katerina. I changed the subject. But since we've been on Earth? She laughs again. You've been with me the whole time. I think you'd know if I had. I laugh too, though my amusement is mixed with sadness. Katerina couldn't have had a boyfriend, even if she wanted one. And it's all because of me. Because she's too busy protecting me. She raises an eyebrow. Why so many questions all of a sudden? Do you have a crush? Seen any cute boys out on the soccer field? She reaches over and pinches my side, tickling me. I squirm away, laughing. No, I say. And it's the truth. Boys practice out there some days, and I watch them, but usually just to measure their athleticism and reflexes, and to compare them to my own. I don't think I could ever like any of them. I don't think I could love anyone who wasn't locked into the struggle with me. I could never respect someone who wasn't part of the war against the Moogs to save Lorien. Back on the TV, the woman is standing in the rain, tears streaming down her face, telling the handsome man that she's changed her mind, that love is all that matters after all. Katerina, I ask. She turns to me. I don't even have to say it out loud. She knows me well. She switches the channels until we find an action movie. We watch it together until we fall asleep.